We hope this explanation of God's Word enriches your life. To help you understand the audience for this talk, we suggest you read the context material on the About Us page. Please read also our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material from philipjensen.com. This talk was recorded at Uni Church on the campus of UNSW, which was attended primarily by undergraduate and postgraduate students who lived on campus or in the suburbs surrounding the university.
Leprosy came to him and begged him on his knees, "If you are willing, you can make me clean." Filled with compassion, Jesus reached out his hand and touched the man. "I am willing," he said, "be clean." A man in the crowd answered, "Teacher, I brought you my son who is possessed by a spirit that has robbed him of speech. Whenever it seizes him, it throws him to the ground and he foams at the mouth, gnashes his teeth and becomes rigid. And I asked your disciples to drive out the spirit, but they could not." "O unbelieving generation," Jesus replied, "how long shall I stay with you? How long shall I put up with you? Bring the boy to me." So they brought him to him. When the spirit saw Jesus, it immediately threw the boy into a convulsion, and he fell to the ground and rolled around, foaming at the mouth. Jesus asked the boy's father, "How long has he been like this?" "From childhood," he answered. "It has often thrown him into the fire and water to kill him, but if you can do anything, take pity on us and help us." "If you can," said Jesus, "everything is possible for him who believes." Immediately the boy's father exclaimed, "I do believe. Help me overcome my unbelief." In the record of the events of the life of Jesus, the reality of language is picked up in all kinds of places. "I do believe." "If you believe, your son can be healed." "I do believe." "What else would you say at such a moment, such a time?" "Help my unbelief." We are a strange mixture of contradictions like that. For if you believe, why do you need help in your unbelief? But what the Father has said was, "If you can, please have mercy on him." And what Jesus challenges is the whole notion that he couldn't do something. Of course he can. It's not a question of whether I can or not. I can. All things are possible with God. I can. It's a question of whether I will. The leper, his was the same question the other way around. "I know you can," he says. "If you will, please make me help." For Jesus to do the great actions that he does requires him to both be able to do something and willing to do something. Moses appeared before Pharaoh, the most powerful man of the world at that time. Moses and his brother Aaron turned up to this man who ruled the great empire of Egypt, the man whom people perceived as divine. And not fully in the sense of we think God, because they had more than 500 gods in Egypt at some stages. But he was a god as much as a man. Moses and Aaron said to Pharaoh, "This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. Let my people go so that they may hold a festival for me in the desert." And Pharaoh says, "Who is this Lord that I should obey him and let Israel go?" We're looking tonight at chapters 5 to 10 of Exodus. We'll be reading snippets on the way through, bits and pieces, jumping back and forth just between those chapters. If you'd care to turn those up, I encourage you to read ahead, and so I hope you have read them so that you'll be able to see whether I'm doing them justice or not in the snippets I take, and so that you'll follow more easily what's being said. And next week there's preparation questions for you on chapters 11 to 13. It's shorter next week. It's an easier section, although one of the critical sections of the whole Bible, as the book of Exodus is. who is this Lord? Do you notice that the word Lord in chapter 5, verse 2, as it is in chapter 5, verse 1, is printed in capital letters all the way through? Because the word there has the word Yahweh. That was most likely not how you pronounced his Hebrew name, but I'll keep using it that way. This is what Yahweh, the God of Israel, says, "Let my people go." Who's Yahweh that I should be obeying him? The God of the slaves. I don't know this Yahweh. I know all kinds of God. I know the sun, and I know the Nile, and I know the sun. But who's Yahweh? So often people are ignorant of God. And when they hear about him, they want to ignore him, as the Pharaoh did. I don't know about him, and I don't want to know about him either. Got enough of our own gods, good, solid citizen Egyptian gods. Why would I need a god of the Jews? Why would I need a god of the slaves? He couldn't be a very powerful god if all he can do is put his people into slavery. I mean, he must be below all the gods that we've got, or any one of the gods. Who is this God, Yahweh? One of the key ways of ignoring God politely is that when you're told about him, you say to the person who tells you, "Well, of course, that's what you believe." That's a lovely put down, isn't it? That says, there is no objective reality out there. There's just your belief, and there's my belief, and there's other people's belief. And you believe that, and someone else believes something else, and somebody, and you're entitled to your belief, and I'm entitled to my belief, and your God is like that. And then they follow it up with that lovely sentence of sheer stupidity: "I like to think of God as..." Doesn't matter what they say after that, you know it's nonsense. I mean, that's like saying, "I like to think of rivers flowing uphill. I like to think of mountains topped with ice cream. I like to think of..." I like to think of all kinds of things, don't I? It's got nothing to do with reality. It is a terrible megalomania to think that the reality of the universe is the way I like to think. But because I think it, therefore it will be. You really do think you're God when you start off the sentence, "I like to think that God is, I like to think of God as, I like to think..." And yet that's so often the case, isn't it? So that when the God of the Bible is made known to them, when they are face to face like Pharaoh with the Yahweh of Israel, people say, "Well, I like to think of God as a loving, kind, gentle person who would never do that kind of thing, and who wouldn't be like that, and who won't make demands upon me." For a couple of hundred years now, it has been popular to accuse Christians of making God in their own image. Christians are accused of it because it has come out of a European tradition. And it's, of course, picked up from the very phrase of the Bible where we're told that man is made in the image of God, and so there's that lovely twist on it that, no, it's not like that at all. God is made in the image of man. That we have just made up our own God. And indeed, when people start off a sentence, "I like to think of God as," that is precisely what they are doing, isn't it? They are making up God in the image that they want. And the image is usually themselves just a bit better and bigger. Me at my best, loving, kind, gentle, but just a little bit better than me at my best. Always loving, always kind, always gentle, powerful, just more powerful than me, but just me writ big. But the Bible gives us a God who is there, who may not be to my liking or who may be to my liking. An objective God who has his character, his plans, his purposes, and who calls upon us to adapt ourselves to him rather than adapt him to us. And therefore we are spared from the terrible trap of making up God in our own image, but we come under the terrible problem of having to deal with the God who has made us in his image. We deal with the God who is God. For as he reveals himself, it may not be anything that we like, but it is the one who is there. And he may make demands upon us that we hate, But if he is the God who is God, then they're the demands that are right for us to fulfill. But as God reveals himself, we must take him. That is, the word God can't be predefined if there is only one God. It's part of the character of uniqueness. You can define something if there are many examples of it. It's called a category, you see. Sheep. A sheep is something, then you can fill out the categories. For it to be a sheep, it will have to have. And then you say, how many legs, what kind of hair, what kind of structure, what kind of... I mean, you can go into very great detail, or you could just have a general kind of, you know, anytime you see a woolly thing. It can be, but because there are lots and lots of examples of that thing, you can define it. But you cannot define anything that is unique. All you can do with something that's unique is describe it. You say, that is what it is like. And you can't define it beforehand. You see, people have got this word God. And in one sense, you can define God because God is a word that refers to anything that somebody else worships. So if you find something that somebody worships, it's a god. It falls into the category called God. It's somebody's god. It may be a pop idol. It might be a sporting idol. It may be a overhead projector. I'm sure in the centuries to come, when the archaeologists dig up the University of New South Wales, they will take this building as a religious cultic place with the god out the front that the people used to all look down upon as they worshipped. I presume that's what they'll call gods. You wonder about archaeologists sometimes as to what they think are gods and are not gods. But if you've got that category god, you see, you can say, well, whatever someone worships. But if there is only one god, then you can't say, well, in order to be God, it must fulfill these requirements, because it is God. All you can do is describe it. Let me pick the difference between a man and Philip Jensen. There's a big difference between those two. If you want to know what a man is, well, there's lots of men, and you can define what a man is, and you can say, yes, he fits in the category of man because he has these certain characteristics. But if you want to define Philip Jensen, you cannot do it. You can only say, yes, that is him. Take him or leave him. That's what he's like. That's the character. That's the very nature of the beast and the animal. Right? You cannot define Yahweh. And so you can't determine what God must be in order for you to accept him as God beforehand. Not if he is who he is. He may be loving and kind and gentle, but he may send plagues upon people. Such plagues that you would hate to be there. Of the blood, the water turning to blood, the land covered with frogs, of the gnats and the flies and the cattle dying and the boils and the hail and the locust and the darkness. And that is also what he sends. Killing hundreds and thousands, destroying the land and the people and the animals, fouling up the environment, something awful. And the reason for these plagues, we're told throughout this section of the Bible, is that you may know. That you may know me. Pharaoh starts off saying, who is Yahweh that I should obey him? And by the end of the nine plagues, or the tenth plague in particular, which we look at next time, Pharaoh knows who the God of Israel is. Doesn't like him, but he knows who he is. And he knows who it is he should be obeying. God is revealing himself by this whole process. So chapter 6, verse 7. Chapter 6, verse 7. I will take you, that is Israel, I will take you as my own people, and I will be your God, and then you will know that I am Yahweh, your God, who brought you out of the yoke of the Egyptian. He's doing this so as to make them his people, so that they will know who he is and that he is the one who rescued them. Chapter 7, verse 4. 7:3 to get the sentence. But I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and though I multiply my miraculous signs and wonders in Egypt, he will not listen to you. Then I will lay my hand on Egypt, and with mighty acts of judgment I will bring out my divisions, my people, the Israelites. And the Egyptians will know that I am Yahweh when I stretch out my hands against Egypt and bring the Israelites out of it. The Egyptians didn't know who Yahweh was. Never heard of this Yahweh. Why would you be worried about what kind of God your slaves worshipped? Why would you think the God of the Israelite slaves was of any significance or value to you? You've got all these hundreds of Egyptian gods. Why would you bother about their stupid God? But after these plagues, they will know who the God of Israel is. Chapter 9, verse 16. But I have raised you up, God says to Pharaoh through Moses. I have raised you up for this very purpose, that I might show you my power and that my name might be proclaimed in all the earth. It's not just that Israel might know, it's not just that the Egyptians might know, but the whole world might know who the God of Israel is. The structure of the passage is fairly straightforward. There are these encounters between Moses and Pharaoh. The first encounter in chapters 5 through to 7:7 is really a failure. The second encounter is a very short one down in chapter 7 verses 8 through to 13, just 5 verses or so, when Moses contends with Pharaoh over the staff that turns into a snake. And when that fails, the third encounter occurs, and the third encounter really is a series of encounters, the nine plagues, or the nine blows, really. The nine blows that take place one after another, and there's a series of these encounters caught up with the nine plagues. Let's just run through them quickly so that we can remind ourselves of them. The first encounter was a real failure. Let my people go, verses 1 and 2. Real command, real authority. See, he has just met God out in the burning bush, out in the wilderness. He is now overwhelmed by the authority and power and magnificence and might of God. And he romps into Pharaoh and says, God says, let my people go. And Pharaoh says, who's God? And Moses then says, please, in verse 3. The God of Hebrews, he's met with us. Now, look. Let us take 3 days into the desert and offer sacrifice to the Lord, or he will strike us, not you, strike us with plagues and with a sword. If you don't mind, Mr. Pharaoh, it'd be a great help to us if you would just let us go. And the king says, get lost, not really like that. He says, you stay. What are you talking about, taking the people away from their labour? That's not on. And so there is no way that's going to take place. You're just a lazy lot here. You're just trying to get out of work. No, you get back to work. The Egyptian economy was built on slavery. The idea that you could let the slaves go is an absurdity. The slave was to Egypt what machines and electricity is to us. I mean, how would we get anything done if we could have no machinery and no electricity? I mean, look at the fear that ran through the Western world when we thought of the possibility we're going to have no oil and petroleum products. You suddenly discovered how many things of your life, from even plastic light switches, which are caught up with petroleum products, you're going to just suddenly do away with them. Well, of course, they didn't have electricity in that day and age, and they didn't have machines. They just had slaves. That's all they had. And now you're being asked to let all the slaves go. Not likely. Shoot myself in the foot, chop the hands off and remove half my brain. It's a ridiculous request. Pharaoh's not going to come at that. He says, no, get back to work. But this time, it's more than that. Get back to work and I'm going to make it a bit harder for you. You want to cop out of your work? Make the same number of bricks, but you've got to collect the straw yourself for it, rather than have the straw provided. There's different words for straw that are used here. One is actually a word, the straw that was provided for them was good quality straw. What they could only scrounge was the kind of chaff that was blown through the air.
So you had to go chasing around, picking up chaff all over the place, wherever you could get anything anywhere that you could throw into the clay so as to make bricks. Well, it was almost impossible for them to be able to get through the same number of bricks each day while they were having to collect up the straw as well. And so verse 15, you see the foreman protest. And they say, hey, we can't do this. To which Pharaoh says, you are a lot of lazy coots, aren't you? Verse 17. Lazy, that's what you are, lazy. That is why you keep saying, let's go and sacrifice to this Yahweh. You don't want to go sacrifice to the Yahweh, you want a holiday. You talk about holy days, but they're just holidays. That's all you're after, 3 days off. Who has that? There's no weekends in Egypt, not for slaves. There's certainly no long weekends. It's not the land of the long weekend there. At that point, the foremen get cold feet. The Israelite foremen realised they were in trouble when they were told, you are not to reduce the number of bricks required of you each day. And when they left Pharaoh, they found Moses and Aaron waiting to meet them, and they said, may the Lord look upon you and judge you. You have made us a stench to Pharaoh and his officials and have put a sword into their hands to kill us. Cold feet indeed. So true of human nature, isn't it? Someone comes along and to champion your cause and says, look, I'll solve your problems. I'll get you out of difficulty. It's easy. We'll just go and do this. And say, oh, yeah, okay, I'm for that. And as soon as the heavy hand of authority comes down, you say, oh, why did he do that for us? He's made life harder for us. We don't want him. They thought they'd actually somehow get out of Egypt without a fight, without a tussle. It's not likely. And so they turn on Moses, as you'll find throughout the whole series of the Exodus, they keep turning on poor old Moses and saying, why are you doing this for us? We were better off back there. It was, life was much easier back there. It's the character of it, you know. If you're ever going to take on a fight on behalf of other people, you must expect your friends to stab you in the back. Moses starts to get cold feet at that too. Moses is never full of too much courage. And he's returned to the Lord, verse 22, and said, oh Lord, why have you brought trouble upon this people? Is this why you sent me? Ever since I went to Pharaoh to speak in your name, he's brought trouble upon the people, and you have not rescued the people at all. They underestimate how hard it is going to be to get the people out of Egypt, totally. But at this point, God reveals again his plans to them. He reveals that he is Yahweh, that he is drawing closer to them than he has ever been to the people before. He is going to be closer to them now than he was to Abraham, Isaac and Jacob, because they are going to know his name like the patriarchs didn't know his name. The patriarchs only knew him as God. You're going to know me as Yahweh. See the difference between the two. God is a description of a thing. Yahweh is the name of a person. He is the personal God, Yahweh. You're going to know me as the one who keeps promises, who makes promises and keeps promises, the one who rescues you, the one who is going to be your God, and you are going to be my people. You are going to know me like no one has ever known me before. It's interesting in the Bible that the names of the people in the Bible reflect that little passage in chapter 6. Names reflect culture. I guess we see that in terms of overseas students. That's one of the few places we see it. When you're living in your own culture, you just assume names are all normal. It's when you actually live with people of other cultures that you start to see how names are so culturally caught up. So that the Chinese pattern of using the family name first and the given names after that. The choice of Anglo-Saxon names of overseas students actually strikes Australians as strange. They're nearly all 19th century Victorian names that are chosen, which is an interesting pattern, which I've never actually been able to unravel and find out why it is so. Well, you'll explain it to me sometime. The choice of names that actually go through fads and fashion in our society that drop in and drop out of fashion, so that Kylie, about 20 years ago, was all the way in, whereas these days it's all the way out, although you would think Miss Minogue would bring it back in for us, but it apparently isn't. That names pass through distinct generational fashions and fads. But there are other ones too. If you meet Ahmed, then you don't expect him to be Chinese, do you? Right? That you'll have the... In fact, you've got a good chance that if someone has a certain set of names, like Muhammad or Abdul, that he is going to come from a particular kind of ethnic and religious background. Well, likewise, Judaism has its kind of sets of names, as does Christianity. So there's a whole string of names that Christianity has made popular, like Peter and John and James and Matthew and Philip and all kinds of good names. Matthew's actually got a little bit more of a Hebrew overtone, and the Jewish names, though, are very clear. What are some of the good Jewish names you can think of? Aaron, Abraham, Joshua, yeah. Sorry? Daniel, right? All kinds of good names. When you meet people with this kind of name, you think, oh, there's a good chance. I've got a daughter called Ruth, and I've discovered that by and large the people who call their children Ruth are either Jewish or actually active practicing Christians. It's a name that pagans don't use. It's a non-fashionable name. It's a marvellous name because it's very easy to spell, only four letters, and you can usually get them in the right order. You've got more chance than longer names anyway. And it's a giveaway as to the kinds of things that you think are important, that you would use that kind of name as opposed to this kind of name. And so there is a thing called Christian names. And there are things that are not Christian names. I wouldn't think Ahmad is a Christian name. Abdul is a Christian name. I don't think they're Christian names, whereas Peter, John, they're very Christian names. One of the interesting things when you reflect on the Old Testament names is that the real Jewish names nearly all have Yahweh in them, usually in terms of the YAH noise, the Yah, Amaziah, right? Hezekiah, Jeremiah, Isaiah, right? All those Hebrew names which end Yah, right? Sometimes they have Yah at the beginning of it too, right? That you can pick up, but it will have that because they have picked on their God, Yahweh, as part of their name. That's a very common. But it's interesting that prior to the Exodus, the names of the Israelite heroes don't have Yahweh in their name. Abraham. Isaac. Jacob. Israel, El is the word for God, man of God, or something like that. They don't have Yah in it, even Moses, even Aaron. The tribes, Gad, Manasseh. Manasseh you might think has, but it hasn't. Actually, it's Manasseh. But it's later that they all start using Yahweh, which is what chapter 6 of Exodus is saying. That they came to know God personally as Yahweh in the Exodus. Now, you will find in Genesis that that Abraham calls God Yahweh. Right? That's written back in later, he's addressing God who is the God who happens to be Yahweh, but he doesn't know God as Yahweh. Now they're going to learn Yahweh, and part of being Yahweh has got to do with the character of the man. The character of God. The character that's caught up in the name. Now, some of you have got names that actually mean things, very simple words like joy. We don't have got any joys here, have we? Got any hopes here? Got any patiences here? They also are nice Victorian kinds of names. In the Reformation, it was very common to give people names of verses of the Bible, which is a very funny way of doing. You know, God is love, Smith, and that's very Christianized and a little bit unusual. But you can sum it down to charity, patience, peace, joy, unfortunately gay. Now, the name Yahweh, what's it mean? It means the faithful, loving one, the rescuing one, the one who keeps his promises to his forefathers, the God who is going to reveal himself to the people in the Exodus. Therefore say to the Israelites 6:6, I am Yahweh, and I will bring you out from under the yoke of the Egyptians. I will free you from being slaves to them. I will redeem you as an outstretched arm of the mighty axe of judgment. I will take you of my own people, and I will be your God, and you will know that I am Yahweh, your God, who brought you out from under the yoke of the Egyptians. And I will bring you to the land I swore with the uplifted hand to give to Abraham, to Isaac, to Jacob. And I will give it to you as a possession, for I am Yahweh. If you want to understand what Yahweh means, it means all that. That's what his name is about. The Saviour, the Redeemer, the Rescuer, the faithful one who keeps his promise and rescues the people and gives them the promised land. He is the God of Israel. And his revelation is part and parcel of the process that is taking place in this redemption. The second encounter that occurs in verses 8 to 13 is very brief. Moses and Aaron, verse 10, went to Pharaoh, did just as the Lord commanded. Aaron threw his staff down in front of Pharaoh and his officials, and it became a snake. And then Pharaoh summoned wise men and sorcerers and the Egyptian magicians, and they also did the same thing by their secret arts. Each one threw down his staff and it became a snake, but Aaron's staff swallowed up their staffs. Yet Pharaoh's heart became hard, and he would not listen to them, just as the Lord had said. They didn't get much further at the second encounter, but it's an interesting little one. The activity of being able to turn a staff into a snake is a magician's trick, still practiced in the Middle East. It has to do with actually having a snake in the first place, that you're paralysed so that it's actually rigid, and then at being bounced down on the ground, it takes to better side. And it's a trick that is still practiced to this day. However, of course, the snake was a very important symbol within Egyptian culture and religion. The symbol of the snake actually sat on the crown of the pharaoh. It was very important, and the victory of Aaron's snake over the others was a fairly obvious, striking one, but not significant enough, for Pharaoh's heart was hard. Then commences the nine plagues. There really, the word plague is not used. Plague is our word. Plague is the kind of thing that means, what, things have gone wrong, pestilence, dreadful occurrences. But the Bible is much clearer. They're actually the blows that God strikes upon them, the strikes that, of God. He bangs them nine times, the nine blows of God. The water turning to blood, the land covered in frogs, then gnats, then flies, the cattle death, the boils, the hail, the locusts, and the darkness listed down there for you. Some of them Moses comes and warns beforehand, like in Numbers 1 and 2, and some of them Moses doesn't, like in 3 and 6. Some of them Aaron is with him, and sometimes he does it without Aaron. Sometimes Pharaoh promises to relent and let the people go, and then he goes back on his word, and sometimes he doesn't. There's all kinds of varieties in how it happens, although as you read through, it's nine episodes that take place. People have argued and have demonstrated to some extent that all of these can actually be natural causes. That if there was a sufficient flood in the headwaters of the Nile, it would cause a whole string of catastrophes and just the right conditions all coming together. Those nine events taking place in the land. The Bible, of course, is not interested really much in secondary causes for things. It's saying God did it. Whether God did it by using floodwaters down in Central Africa and things like that or not, really the Bible's not interested. The fact that the nine things happened at the time Moses said they should happen really is the point. That's not to say that God didn't use secondary causes. On one hand, you've got the materialist, mechanist person who says everything has got kind of materialistic, mechanistic causes and God has no part to play. On the other hand, you've got the supernaturalist whiz-bangers who say that, you know, if it's to be a miracle, then God has to interfere with the natural order of things. And if God used a natural cause for something to bring about, well, then God didn't do it at all. Both of them are actually in a warped view, mechanistic in their thinking, because they do not see God supervising everything. The person who thinks that God has to interfere with the laws of nature for a miracle to take place is as godless as the person who thinks that God can't do it at all. Look just for a moment at chapter 10, just to see the point I'm making. Chapter 10, verse, in the plague of locusts, verse 13. So Moses stretched out his staff over Egypt, and the Lord made an east wind blow across the land all that day and all that night, and by morning the wind had brought the locusts. How did the locusts get there? Well, you could say because the wind brought them. You could say because Moses called upon God to send them. You could say because God sent them. But you see how God used the natural order, namely the wind, to bring about his purposes. And then again down in verse, 19 of the same passage. And the Lord changed the wind to a very strong west wind, which caught up the locusts and carried them into the Red Sea, and not a locust was left anywhere in Egypt. See, God uses natural causes to bring about his purposes. He needn't use natural causes, but you mustn't exclude him using natural causes either. I think he most normally does. But throughout these, there are certain themes that come out. Pharaoh's heart being hardened, the magician's failure, the greater and greater demands of Moses, and the rising tension and climax of the story. So let's just look at those themes. Firstly is the magician's theme. See, the court magicians could do many of the things Moses could do. But Moses does it without any skill, without any knowledge, without any spells or tricks. Moses, basically, if you notice the story, doesn't know what he's doing, does he? Right? He doesn't know what to do next. God keeps telling him, go and do this, go and do that. He goes out and does it, and it happens. I think he's as surprised as Pharaoh is. Right? He's not planning it. Whereas the magicians have got their skills and their tricks, their spells, their incantations, and by which they can do things. They can have snakes, just like Moses can have a snake in chapter 5, verse 12, and so on. They can turn the water into blood, chapter 5, verse 22. See, the Pharaoh is unimpressed because... That's not 5, can't be 5, can it? It must be 7:22, mustn't it? Yeah, but the Egyptian magicians did the same thing by their secret arts. And Pharaoh's heart became hard. He wouldn't listen to Moses and Aaron, just as the Lord said. He's unimpressed by that first miracle because, after all, his own boys, the court magicians, can do the same trick of turning water into blood. Or again, the frogs. They can produce frogs in chapter 8, verse 7. You wonder why they'd want to, but they can. I mean, the land's covered with them, and then they go and do some themselves. Chapter 8, verse 6. So Aaron stretched out his hand over the waters of Egypt, and the frogs came up and covered the land. But the magicians did the same thing by their secret arts. They also made frogs come up on the land of Egypt. And so Pharaoh says, big deal, whoopee, you can do what I can do. So what? You've got no power. But when it comes to the gnats, down in verse 16, the Lord said to Moses, tell Aaron to stretch out the staff and strike the dust of the ground, and throughout the land of Egypt the dust will become gnats. They did this, and when Aaron stretched out his hand, the staff, and struck the dust, the ground became gnats, came among men and animals, etc., the dust throughout the land, etc. 18. But when the magicians tried to produce gnats by their secret arts, they could not. And the gnats were on men and animals. And the magician said to Pharaoh, this is the finger of God. But Pharaoh's heart was hard and he wouldn't listen, just as the Lord had said. See, there came an end point to what the magicians could do. And when the magicians saw that this was beyond anything they knew of, they started to say, hang on, maybe we're dealing with God here. But the victory over the magicians is more than a confession of faith that this is the finger of God. There's the terrible ignominy down in chapter 9, verse 11. So they took the soot from the furnace and stood before Pharaoh. Moses tossed it into the air, and the festering boils broke out on men and animals. And the magicians couldn't stand before Moses because of the boils that were on them and on all the Egyptians. The magicians really are defeated. At first, you see, it looks like in the second episode when they had the snakes, it looks like Moses will be able to be held at bay because the magicians can do everything Moses can do. But gradually, the magicians are beaten. Throughout the section, there is a practice of conciliation and arbitration taking place. There's negotiations which are marvellous for those of you in industrial relations. See, at first up, they're saying, can we go to a festival in chapter 5, verse 1? And Pharaoh says, no, you're just a bunch of lazy coots. Chapter 7, verse 16, they're still saying, can we go to a festival and worship God out in the wilderness? And Pharaoh's still saying, no, you're just being lazy. In chapter 8, verse 1, they're still saying, we want to go out into the wilderness to worship our God. And Pharaoh's saying, yes, but then a few verses later, no, no, we can't do it. And then in chapter 8, he also says, well, hang on, why do you have to go out into the wilderness to worship your God? Why can't you worship your God here in Egypt? Now, that's a very clever piece of creative industrial relationships, you see. What am I afraid of? I'm afraid that when you mob get out there in the wilderness, you'll rack off and I won't have any slaves left. Now, I know that's what you're after. I also don't want you to lose 3 days' work. But I'm going through all these rough times of the plagues and I can't afford to keep on having these plagues there. I'm losing more than 3 days' work through the plagues. So I'll give in to you a little bit and say, okay, you can have a day to worship God here in Egypt where we can keep you under control. I think it's in 8:20, isn't it? Then the Lord said, let my people go again. Where is it? 22? 25. Then Pharaoh summoned Moses and Aaron and said, go sacrifice to your God here in this land. Moses said, that wouldn't be right. Marvellous answer here. The sacrifices we offer the Lord our God would be detestable to the Egyptians. And if we offer sacrifices that are detestable in your eyes, well, they'll stone us. No, no, we've got to go 3 days' journey into the desert and offer sacrifices out there where you can't see, just as our God has commanded us. And he says, no, I won't let you go and offer sacrifices to your God. I will let you go and offer them but in the desert, but you mustn't go far. You're not to go 3 days away. I'll never catch you if you go 3 days away, is the hidden thing. But Moses is insistent they've got to go that 3 days. So it's, you can go, but not very far. The next kind of conciliation comes in chapter 10, verse 7, where he tries to limit who can go. Pharaoh's official said to him, verse 7, how long will this man be a snare to us? Let the people go so that they may worship Yahweh their God. Do you not realize that Egypt is ruined? Then Moses and Aaron were brought back to Pharaoh. Go worship the Lord your God, he said. But just who will be going? Moses said, we will be going with our young and our old and our sons and daughters and the flocks and the herds because we're to celebrate a festival to Yahweh. And Pharaoh said, Yahweh then be with you. If I let you go along with your women and children, clearly you're bent on evil. No, have only the men to go and worship Yahweh, since that's what you've been asking for. And then they were driven out. Moses, of course, won't have that. Down verse 24, 26, you find him saying, Pharaoh summoned Moses and said, go worship Yahweh. Even your women and children may go. Only leave your flocks and herds behind. So there's step by step, he's saying, okay, only the men can go. He knows they'll come back for the women. The children, they're not going to go out and die as a bunch of men out there. It's not likely. No, okay, all of you can go, but you've got to leave all the stock here. Well, it's not just that you'll have to come back for your stock because you want your money. You'll have to come back for your stock because what are you going to live out on the desert on? The vegetation? Hardly. The only chance you've got is to carry stock with you. So again, you'll have to come back. Moses said, you know, you've got to let us take the animals because we don't know which ones to sacrifice yet. Something like that. Verse 25, Moses said, you must allow us to have sacrifices and burnt offerings to present the Lord our God. Our livestock too must go with us. Not a hoof is to be left behind. We have to use some of them in worshipping Yahweh our God. And until we get there, we will not know what we're to use to worship Yahweh. It's a lovely argument, isn't it? You see where Jewish humour comes from, don't you? In the end, of course, Pharaoh says, get out, I never want to see you again. The third theme that runs through the passage is divine discrimination. Israel is chosen, Egypt is rejected. Israel is chosen because the covenant promises made to Abraham, Isaac and Jacob. They are God's people. He has chosen them. And chosen because God hears their groanings. But they're not chosen because they're good or moral or religious or brave or powerful. They're a bunch of cowardly slaves. Israel is favoured and Egypt is distinguished from Israel even in the plagues. Some of the plagues don't fall on the people of Israel. So in chapter 8, verses 22 to 23, which one's that going to be? That must be the... I can't see that then. Must be the flies, is it? How can you have 8:23? Does it exist? Oh, I see. That's wrong. The outline there under point 2C4 should read 8:20 to 8:32. That's what's wrong. 23, I'll make a distinction between my people and your people. And that miraculous sign will occur tomorrow so that the flies didn't go to Goshen where the people of Israel were. Or again, the same thing happens in chapter 9, verse 26, that the hail didn't fall on the people of Israel. Or again, the same thing happens in 10:23, that the darkness doesn't come upon Goshen, where the people of Israel were. That is, Israel is distinguished from Egypt, even in the plagues, and especially in the 10th one we look at next week, the Passover. Because Israel was God's people. Yahweh was their God. Within Egypt there's some distinction too. God does warn the Egyptians in chapter 9 about the hail. And those who take notice of God's warning and bring their animals and livestock in under shelter and are protected from it, and those who reject, like Pharaoh, God, well, they suffer the consequences. But within Egypt, one man in particular is distinguished by God, Pharaoh, and his heart is hardened. Sometimes it is spoken about it being hard. Sometimes it's spoken about as Pharaoh hardening his own heart. Sometimes it's spoken about as God hardening Pharaoh's heart. So, for example, note takers, here we go. Pharaoh's heart itself being hard, chapter 7, verse 13. 7:22 and 9:7. I read 7:13 for you. Yet Pharaoh's heart became hard, and he would not listen to them, just as the Lord had said. It doesn't say who hardens it then, does it? It just says it was hard. He had a hard heart. And that hard heart was a shell which stopped him listening. Sometimes he hardens it. Chapter 8, verse 15. Chapter 8, verse 15. When Pharaoh saw that there was relief, he hardened his heart and would not listen to Moses and Aaron, just as the Lord had said. You'll find it in 8:32 as well. But more often it talks about God hardening his heart. That was warned to us right back in chapter 4, verse 1, the passage from last week. 4, verse 21. The Lord said to Moses, when you return to Egypt, see that you perform before Pharaoh all the wonders I have given you the power to do, but I will harden his heart so that he will not let the people go. And that's repeated for us in chapter 7, verse 3. 7:3, 9:12, 10:1, 10:20, 10:27, that God hardens Pharaoh's heart. Now the purpose of this hardening of the heart is so that the man will not listen. Chapter 7, verse 3 is a good illustration of it. I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and though I multiply miraculous signs and wonders in Egypt, he will not listen to you. But it's also so as to reveal who God is. Chapter 10, verse 1. Then the Lord said to Moses, go to Pharaoh, for I have hardened his heart and the hearts of his officials, so that I may perform these miraculous signs of mine among them, that you may tell the children and grandchildren how I dealt harshly with the Egyptians. That God actually hardens the heart so that the toll program can take place. Notice three little points of it. One is that it is God's work. God takes the initiative throughout. He is not at the disposal of Pharaoh. Pharaoh is at the disposal of God. It's God's work. 10 verse 1. Then the Lord said to Moses, go to Pharaoh, for I have hardened his heart and the hearts of his officials, so that I may perform these miraculous signs of mine among them, that you may tell the children and grandchildren how I dealt harshly with the Egyptians. That God actually hardens the heart so that the toll program can take place. Notice three little points of it. One is that it is God's work. God takes the initiative throughout. He is not at the disposal of Pharaoh. Pharaoh is at the disposal of God. It's God's work. Secondly, notice that God hardens hearts for purposes. He's hardening Pharaoh's heart for the purpose of revealing his will, of rescuing the people. Thirdly, notice that God has a willing subject in the person of Pharaoh. He doesn't harden the heart of somebody who is opposed to having his heart hardened. He hardens the heart of the man who happily hardens his own heart. So he doesn't work against Pharaoh's will. He works with Pharaoh's will. He puts Pharaoh's will into effect, and Pharaoh puts God's will into effect. However, that brings us to really the fourth theme, that is, the divine initiative runs through this whole passage. God is picking a fight with Pharaoh to rescue Israel. Moses and Aaron are only agents, they're not initiators. They don't know what they're doing. Israel's totally powerless. It doesn't know what it's doing. It's not doing anything. Egypt is opposed to God. The whole action takes place because God has chosen to do it. And that tells us a lot about God that you and I, if we come from a Christianized background, just take for granted. That is, God is not a passive, waiting to be found, impotent being, unmoved and uninvolved in the affairs of this world, accidentally trampling people underfoot when he gets out of bed in the morning. God is a purposive initiator who is actively a participant in this world, who rules the affairs of mankind, and who has a plan and a program that he is putting into effect, and will use everything, even his enemies, to put his plans and purposes into effect. That is, the whole thing reveals to us a lot about God. It reveals to us the character of God in bringing his people to acknowledge him, to live by him, to see him for who he is and what his plans are. You see, Pharaoh's opening response in chapter 5, verse 2 is being very loudly answered. Who is Yahweh that I should obey him? And the answer is the God of gods and Lord of lords, the ruler of the universe, who has chosen out his people and will do anything to rescue them and save you, and against whom you are like us, a little ant to be squashed. Who is Yahweh that I should obey him? He's God. That's who Yahweh is, you silly blithering idiot. The whole thing answers it very loudly and clearly. Who is Yahweh? Yahweh was revealed to the patriarchs as El Shaddai, as God Almighty, but now he is being revealed as the covenant-keeping Saviour as well. A revelation so that the Egyptians will know God, the magicians will know God, Israel will know God, all will know God. Pick those verses up so you can see it. 7:5. And the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord when I stretch out my hand against Egypt and bring the Israelites out of it. By the end of these 10 plagues, the Egyptians not only sent the children of Israel out, but said, look, would you like to take our money with us? And they gave their money and their jewelry, anything to get rid of the Egyptians, because they knew the God of Israel was more powerful, and he'd get rid of the Israelites, anything. Because they knew the God of Israel was more powerful than anything they'd ever dealt with before, any god they had. Certainly much more powerful than silly old Pharaoh. The Egyptians knew. The magicians knew. They said to Pharaoh, this, there's nothing about magic here. This is the finger of God in chapter 8, verse 19, 8:19. And Israel was to know in chapters 10, verses 1 and 2, I've hardened his heart and the hearts of his officials, so that you may tell your children and grandchildren how I dealt harshly with the Egyptians and how I performed signs among them, that you might know I am Yahweh. And indeed, it's so that all will know. Chapter 9, verse 16. Chapter 9, verse 16. I have raised you, Pharaoh, up for this very purpose, that I might show you my power, and that my name might be proclaimed in all the earth, that throughout the world people will know. And they did. When the children of Israel were living in the land of Palestine and coming into the land of Palestine, everybody knew. You write down 1 Samuel 4:18, and I'll read it for you. 1 Samuel 4:18. Can't believe this is right. And it's not. Where's that going to be? It's going to be 4:18, but it's going to be earlier than that, surely. Joshua 4:18? I tell you, I had a bad day today, didn't I? I've never written so many references down incorrectly. Where is it? Where the people in Palestine stand in awe of the Israelites as they come in the conquest. Joshua 2:10. Thank you, Joshua. Joshua 2:10. Okay, pick it up from verse 8. Before the spies lay down on the night, she went up. Rahab, the prostitute who's looked after the spies. The spies lay down in the night. She went up on the roof and said to them, I know that the Lord, I know Yahweh has given this land to you and that a great fear of you has fallen on us, so that all who live in this country are melting in fear because of you. We have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea for you when you came out of Egypt and what you did to Sodom. The reputation of the Jews went before them in the promised land. It wasn't the reputation of the Jews. It was the great reputation of the God of the Jews. For he did such incredible things for them. It's not the passage I meant, but it'll do. Of what? Joshua 4:24 will say the same thing. Will it? Yes, he did this so that all the peoples of the earth might know that the hand of Yahweh is powerful and that you'll always fear Yahweh your God. That's not the verse I had in mind either, but it's even better than the one I had in mind. Thank you. 4:24. You see, what do you make of the Jews? What do you make of the Jews? To this very day, they are the most troublesome people in the world, aren't they? There's as much chance that the Jewish nation will cause Third World War as any other nation, isn't there? And the Middle East is still the problem spot of this world. It's a fascinating thing, isn't it? The Jews are still the people that the world hates. Stalin tried, as the Russians have consistently tried in their pogroms, to destroy them. Hitler had a really good bash at them. 6 million. All around the world, people hate them. One of the main golf courses here in the eastern suburbs of Sydney doesn't allow them to be members. That's classic, isn't it? Talk about racism. Here, alive and well, living in Sydney, not allowed to be a member of a course. Indeed, one of the courses that was founded by the Jews. After a few years, they allowed Gentiles in the course. The Gentiles overtook the clubhouse, and in the end, they refused to allow any Jews in. So the Jews built another course out at Monash. It's extraordinary, isn't it? There's no group in this world who seems to have such universal hatred poured upon them as the Jews. No group in this world that so many people have tried to destroy and remove from the face of the earth, and yet it's the one culture that comes right from this time through to today. A nation that has never been powerful, never been strong, never been militaristic. It's a tiny group of people, really. They've never been in anything, except for a very short period under King David, and that was because everybody else was weak at the time. They've never been in anything, and yet they're still around. How come? What is it about the Jews that make them what they are? The answer of the Bible is that God has chosen them to be his people. How did a group of slaves get away out of Egypt? The answer of the Bible is that God rescued them. That the thing that marks them off as distinctive is their God. Do you know their God? I mean, it's nice to have your own pet God, isn't it? One made to your own liking, one who kind of fits in with your image of what a good God would be like. But do you know the one who is there, the Almighty God, the ruler of the universe, who makes promises and who keeps them, and who is actively involved in the affairs of mankind, choosing out his own people whom he saved, and hardening the hearts of his enemies so as to be able to bring about his miraculous, victorious conquest of them, forgiving people and showing mercy to them as he hardens? Do you know the God of Israel, who sent his son into the world to die for the sins of the Gentiles as well as the Jews, and who through that great work of resurrecting a dead man has established the kingdom of God on earth? For where does Christ come from? But the Jews and God. Our God is able to save. And our God is willing to save. He is able and willing. And the plagues demonstrate them, as the miracles of Jesus demonstrates it. Our God is able and willing. But by having him as an able and willing God, he's not one that you stand up and say stupid things to like Pharaoh did. Who do you think you are to tell me how to live? He is God, God. He rules. And you oppose him, you'll be defeated. If you want to ask questions and make comments about this passage or what I've been saying tonight.
Moses being deliberately deceptive when he's talking to Pharaoh about going into the wilderness for 3 days?
Isn't Moses being purposely deceptive when he talks about going out there for 3 days? Dissembling is the correct term. There's a difference between deceiving and dissembling. Dissembling is a passive intransitive verb. Dissembling is something that whereby you do not reveal the whole story. While not at the same time telling the lie. Now it's cloaking the story. And that's what he is doing, he's dissembling. How much he understood himself as to what was going to happen is not sure. And he says, let us go out to spend, we've got to go out at least 3 days to worship God. It's absolutely true. He had to go out that far. He didn't say anything about when he was coming back. Mind you, he didn't get very far in dissembling. The Pharaoh understood very clearly that 3 days out there was no way he was going to come back. Is. Well, it is and it isn't. The people of the land is one of the favourite ways that Jews like to talk about themselves because they were the people of the promised land. And after a while, you just drop the word promise, especially when you're in the land, the promised land. So you just call yourself the people of the land. It's a bit of out of keeping here, way back in Exodus. But it can have the other meaning, that is, the rural workers, the labourers, the navvies. And so you're not going to take, you know, all my workers away from me, which presumably is what Pharaoh means by it, but it's one of those things that the Jew might like to record, that Pharaoh called them the people of the land. After all, we are. Yep.
On the idea of trying to explain the retaining of blood by blood, it doesn't seem to wash very well.
Sorry. Preaching on the flood is almost impossible because you never find out how many English metaphors use water until you start preaching on the flood. Anyway, go on.
In chapter 7, verse 19, it says all the water in Egypt has been turned into blood, even that's in the wooden buckets and stone jars, so presumably all stuff has been stored away. Even that's going to
happen. Good, thank you. That's an interesting point that Tim's raised for us. That if you're just using the naturalistic explanations that a great flood took place at the headwaters of the Nile, which carried down red silt into the Nile, etc., it won't explain a verse like 7:19, which talks about the water in the buckets turning into blood. Now, you could stretch the language in terms of saying, yes, that's right, when you take the water out of the Nile in the buckets, it'll be blood. Right? But it sounds as if the water that's already stored up in the buckets is going to turn into blood, which wouldn't be meant if you just got the Nile waters. I wouldn't want to go to the stake for it either way, but I don't think they're thinking in natural causes at all. But it is interesting that someone has been able to construct a whole series of events that could explain those. The first 9, the 10th one, there's no natural explanations. tenth one's a different character because it's the firstborn son of every family. You know, that's a very weird one. Can't even use the RH negative things on that. Last question. Thank you. I mentioned the Jews are still living on. I mentioned them as the chosen people. I pointed out how odd it is that they do continue, because you, after all, you don't meet many Moabites or Hittites, Hivites, Jebusites, or any of the other kind of ites these days. But you do meet them. But you say, well, now, does that mean they are still the chosen people in terms of being saved people? And the answer is that the gospel comes to the Jew first and then to the Gentile, that they always have a special place within the plans and purposes of God. But if they are truly of the people of God, then they become Christians.
Thank you for listening to the talks on philipjensen.com. Please check our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material on philipjensen.com.